Okay, now I welcome everybody
who came for the talk
or for the day or people who weren't here last night. And I'd also like to say on behalf of everyone bye-bye and thank you so much to Zena, our manager, who's leaving tonight because she has to go back to her job tomorrow. But all the time and heart and effort that you've put in made the retreat run smoothly. Thank you. So I was happy about the emphasis on metta in the question and answer today, since Eric and I had agreed that the retreat would be about love and awareness, or love and wisdom. So this talk is one sort of stab in that direction of trying to discuss the two together, how they are similar, how they're the same. And just for starters, I'm thinking that the Buddha's experience was of wisdom, or of penetrating the emptiness of all things, and his own liberation. But the teaching that he left behind is his love, his wish for us to also reach understanding. And as such, I hope to pass on, you know, as much of that intact meaning as I can within my own understanding, and in hopes that, you know, the sort of karmic connection that we have allows for some of it to get across. And, you know, may the bird of paradise make its nest in your heart, or whatever. As a subway driver once said on the Red Line in Cambridge, rather surprisingly. Anyway, the last Dharma event that I was at was just last weekend, and when I went to Radio City Music Hall to hear the Dalai Lama speak, and I thought that his approach to love and wisdom was really kind of perfect. So I'm going to quote a little bit from him to start, or paraphrase from my notes. Here's something he said on the second day. We all care about ourselves very deeply. We care about our own welfare and happiness. This is the basis from which we can extend caring to those around us. This care is rooted in our biology. Our birth and survival depend upon an immense degree of care. The bond and closeness between a mother and child is necessary for our survival as infants. And all of our mothers, I'll parenthetically say, imperfect as they were, faced a great deal of hardship internally and externally in bringing us up. And the fact that they did at least an adequate job is shown by the fact that we actually did survive. We received at least some of what we needed from life to get us here. Going on with the Dalai Lama, the mother and child reach out to each other. This is the basis of relationship, and this brings us into relationship with ourselves and with our world. So he's saying that love is why we exist, in a sense, love and connection, and we still need it in order to survive. I was recently speaking with a friend who had this idea that there must be enlightened beings somewhere in the world who are completely self-sufficient, living on roots and berries and needing no one and nothing. And I thought, well, reality check, you know, it takes quite a bit to keep a person going, and most of the people who live in caves had donations of some sort, albeit intermittently. So if you spend all your time kind of foraging, why not just go to the ATM? But what does that mean, you know, this ideal that we have that maybe, you know, one day we won't need other people, we won't need to be around other people, and we won't have to fuss with other people. Love is why we exist, 6 billion of us. This is also an excuse that I heard from an Indian cab driver. He said, that's what Indian people say, is that we're a very loving country. Anyway, so to look at ourselves as human beings, there's both this love side that's innate and really part of us. The Dalai Lama was actually pointing to the real pervasiveness and reality of Buddha nature, of our love nature. And at the same time, we easily become agitated, and we create agitation for one another. More than any other source of pain is the pain of dealing with other human beings, the pain of dealing with ourselves. And looking at ourselves today, speaking from my own side, I will say that my mind is quite like a baby. You know, its moods are quite unstable. Sometimes it's really happy and chortling and getting what it wants, and then other times, dissatisfied, you know, not quite knowing what to do with itself, not, you know, getting picked up or being held in quite the right way by, you know, itself or by circumstances. So to acknowledge that we affect one another very deeply, that we can create actual problems for ourselves, but also we can affect one another for the better. And in this temporary community, the intention of support and of peacefulness and of love for ourselves and one another is something very important. It's not fake. It's not silly. It's not unreal. And when we talk about love in our culture, there's so much emphasis on romance that I thought I should just talk about it a little bit. And I'll talk somewhat about the artificial and downside of it, hoping that that doesn't mean that you think that I think that love, you know, sort of sexual romantic love is all bad, because I don't think that it is at all, and I'm engaged in it myself with all its ups and downs. But, you know, you see when it's turned to commercial purpose some of the most crass evidence of what love has come to, or what the representations of love are. I once knew a woman who worked in Hollywood, and she had written a script about two married people who got estranged and then got back together, and she said she couldn't sell it because that's boring to people, that there has to be a single, you know, there has to be the diciness of this single couple and the erotic attraction between two, you know, gorgeous, straight, white people, highly paid, you know, even sometimes with body doubles to show their leg if this real person's leg is not right. Those people crashing into each other and creating the ideal situation, and then, you know, the movie ends upon this great crescendo of, you know, satisfaction and fulfillment. Well, as we know, if we see the lives of the real people in Hollywood, that how some of them are happy and some of them are not so happy, and some of them are serially unhappy, and they're just like us. Similarly, my husband is an anthropologist, and sometimes when people hark back and say, oh, you know, in indigenous cultures, the men knew how to be men and the women knew how to be women, and it was just so much easier, and that just enrages me whenever I hear it, just on principle, sort of. But I don't want to be an idiot, you know, just a knee-jerk type person who thinks what I think. So I asked him, because he lived for 20 years in the Amazon with a group of people who actually had no plastic buckets, no fish hooks, nothing. You know, they made everything that they owned. It was very, very beautiful the way that their culture was all interwoven, and a lot of metaphors of basket weaving and stuff like that. But he said, oh no, you know, their relationships are just as screwed up as ours. Differently in some ways, but the same. Really the same, you know. Everybody lives together in a big tent, and you can hear them all fighting at night or doing different things at night. And, you know, I mean, the couples form and then they part. So, okay. So we have this natural capacity to be loving. And what is it that's not quite right about this romantic love? Like, we sort of imagine that this is our refuge, you know. We can just get one person and make each other happy and then go off into the sunset. Well, so often, you know, we just end up kind of passively expecting that this crescendo is kind of this naturally sort of hormonal flood is going to last forever. And, you know, actually, I guess it was designed by our genes just to make sure that we procreate. And then after that, it's kind of anybody's guess. I don't know. Then the mother stays around long enough to raise the kid. And after that, evolution doesn't care about us anymore. But there's some way that we just expect this love to be there for us, just to kind of automatically happen. And instead of this sense of, like, ourselves, the loving person that we want to be, we find ourselves unloving and enraged, and finding that, like, our intimate relationships are the places where we see, like, the worst parts of ourselves. And now what? Like the time when I went on a wilderness sort of outdoor guide course, and I thought, you know, someone should have told me how uncomfortable this is. I thought I was going to be out in nature and really have a good time, and it's really, like, horrible. You know, you're wet. Like, I'm always behind. All the men run away, leave me. I'm, like, struggling up the hill. The minute they see me, they say, "Oh, here you are," and then they run off again. And, you know, oh. You know, like, this is what fun, you know. So, I had to kind of do that work myself in order to enjoy the wilderness, to be able to put up with sort of the uncomfortable aspects of it. And it's the same kind of with love or with romantic relationships. We kind of come together and then pick through the wreckage for years afterwards, I guess, something like that. I'm being funny, but... So we have this profound desire and this wish and this inclination to create a sense of happiness or welfare in our lives through connection with other people. And this sense of desire for happiness very often does include finding the loving nature of ourselves and seeing it reciprocated and reflected in those around us. Often I've read sort of therapy books about love, and they say that, you know, a love relationship is actually an achievement. It's kind of a training. It's an ongoing thing. And some of what happens to us, I think, is when we kind of turn off and it's not there for us, and sometimes, you know, there's no compatibility, and we, like, saw each other across the dance floor and end up together, and then suddenly you wake up and you're like, oh, you know, like, no. So that there's some reality to that also, to recognizing when there isn't really a basis in compatibility and connection, when the attraction is of a fleeting sort. But for the long term, I think there has to be a kind of responsibility-based attitude. That after we fall in love, then there's also sort of being in love and generating the attitude of love, much as in the metta practice, and being able to recognize, you know, oneself and the other person as being different and bonded and sometimes connected, sometimes not. Very much like meditation practice. So about this, the beautiful language of Shakespeare, I can't resist. I wondered, Eric, if you're going to use that sonnet 116 tomorrow, too, or whenever you give your talk. You'll give a better...
Let us not to the marriage of true minds?
Yes, can you... You know? Do you want to go ahead and say
no, it's okay.
Let me not to the marriage of true minds admit impediments. Love is not love which alters when it alteration finds, or bends with the remover to remove. Oh no, it is an ever-fixed mark that looks on tempests and is never shaken. It is the star to every wandering bark, whose worth's unknown, although his height be taken. Love's not time's fool, though rosy lips and cheeks within his bending sickles compass come. Love alters not with his brief hours and weeks, but bears it out even to the edge of doom. If this be error and upon me proved, I never writ nor no man ever loved. So it's beautiful, and it speaks to our intuition of what love is or what love is possible. You know, I guess there's just that little grain of salt to put upon the idea that it's going to be the pinnacle of emotions and very gratifying all the time. To see that ordinary love doesn't last forever. It does change. What is sort of the flaw in here? It's both that passive attitude that it's just going to happen. It's also that our love has our own gratification sometimes very selfishly embedded in it. Like, I like you at certain times and I don't like you at other times. I like, you know, I'm in love with you when I feel good around you, and I'm not in love with you. I did an exercise recently with the hair in the tub drain, where I looked at the hair in the tub drain, and normally it seems to me as an emblem of everything that is difficult about living with someone else, that it is always there, it's black, it's a nest, it's like, unclean. I don't produce such hair, and if I produce such hair, I get rid of it so the other person doesn't have to look at it. Blah, 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 blah. So then I looked at it until it became just hair. And it wasn't anything, really. So it was sort of that sort of willingness, I feel, like in myself, to get to not luxuriate in that piece of reactivity, to bring peace of mind to myself, to just, you know, sort of glare at these things in my mind, to cool off in certain things, like that I demand that all hair, tub hair drain be removed before I hit the tub, and otherwise, no. So our unwillingness to meet ourselves where we are, and to meet unwilling to meet the other person where they are, is often really the obstacle in this, that we sort of want the person to come to us, or we want ourselves to be a certain way, or to feel, to have these certain feelings arising automatically. Partial love, conditional love, becomes easily the opposite of love, and anger and hate and separation, which affects us very deeply, affects our health. You know, there's studies showing what happens to your blood flow and your heart and your legs and your arms. Now, there may be something useful at times in really seeing the signals of what we're actually feeling in different moments. You know, I'm not saying to just ride roughshod over your truth in order to connect with someone, which is another kind of temptation. But I'm just saying that we need to examine our emotions very carefully and be willing to be real and to not be reactive in whatever direction. As Supriti was saying this morning, some of us show up in life as a demand, others show up in life as a victim, and are we willing to sort of change some of that in relation to one another? But basically, without going any farther down that road, I would like to talk about the method of how to turn biased love into unbiased love. One of the ways is by looking at ourselves, as we've done here today, to turn biased awareness and biased self-understanding into a more complete awareness and acceptance and being with ourselves. This is sort of the Buddhist method for making the mind a little bit bigger. So taking these two innate aspects of ourselves, our desire to help and benefit others and ourself, and our profound wish for our own freedom and for universal freedom, and making them bigger and expanding them, that's the practice that we're doing here. Why we are here, out of love for ourselves, out of a sense of that potential or aspiration, or because we're desperate and we have some hope, it's all sort of the same thing. Now we have to address at some point the issue or the problem of suffering and limitation. What is it? The first noble truth of the Buddha. I'll be going into that a little bit more deeply in a few moments. But in terms of our sense of our limited scope of our capacity to be with ourselves, our capacity to be with ourselves in the presence of other people, in the presence of any situation, I'm reminded of a friend of mine who was recently at another retreat where they did a their mindful awareness body exercise was taking and holding these yoga postures for long periods of time and finding exactly where was the edge of their discomfort, not into pain and, you know, damaging their ligaments, but also not just sort of being comfortable, but just finding where was the place that the body kind of was a little stuck in, you know, its range of motion, and opening it, resting in the pose and opening it slightly. And I thought that was a really great metaphor for some of the way that we practice here, that I think it will be an unusual person who was not ever uncomfortable at all today, and who, when they were uncomfortable, didn't really want to be comfortable again, and then find that it wasn't possible just to cut into being comfortable just because you want to and you're kind of there with your wanting to be comfortable making you even more uncomfortable like that. So the yin yoga in that is to try to open to those uncomfortable moments as they are, to give yourself a little more space and to see the struggle from a little bit more broad perspective. So to know our edges and to know when we need to take a break, when we need a cup of tea, go to our room, or when to be with it, to persist in the walking period. To really try to see ourselves clearly with some tenderness and some discernment. This act of self-knowing is equal to self-loving, a kind of intimacy with our experience in all its warty forms. To know you is to love you, as they say. This refrain kind of implies that the person is kind of more gooder than other people. But I think if we take this to that very deep place of recognizing our own goodness and our own willingness, sometimes just to say this to ourselves, that to know me is to love me. Take it deep. The teaching is that we all have an innate Buddha nature, which is very much connected with this capacity for natural awareness that we have and for natural affection. And yet, although we all have this potential, very few beings bring together the circumstances where it can come to fruition, where it can be revealed. So in that sonnet, that sense of steadfastness is something that we can take, that sense of even to the edge of doom, determined to love ourselves and others up to the moment of death in some meaningful way. Some of us already have loved other people to the moment of death and even beyond. So we're finding our way, and these instructions are meant to point out that direction, how to practice the union of love and wisdom. So now to go a little bit more deeply into how compassion and wisdom come together, I'll bring the truth of suffering, the first noble truth. Now we can all acknowledge the first, most gross, brutish and obvious fact of suffering in our lives. When things are unpleasant and difficult, it's quite palpable that, and the way our mind engages or sort of misengages with reality, say, you know, when we're not the person we want to be, we're not in the situation we want to be in, just the sort of terrible strain in our mind that is sort of the misfitting of our perception and reality. It's quite hard. And there is such a thing as absolutely brutal pain, you know, the dogs whose paws are being crushed in China for, you know, sort of with total gratuitous uncaring. Think of the world and think of our own pain, our own very real pain as human beings, which at times does come to the edge of what we can really tolerate inwardly and outwardly, physically and mentally, just even the potential for that. We're quite vulnerable. The second variety of pain is called anicca or viparinama dukkha, which is the tendency of things to shift around and not be stable. And the tendency also of pain to shift from the body into the mind and from the mind into the body, and for good circumstances not to last, that there's something kind of unreliable in life that makes life also difficult. Like you get all your ducks in a row and then they swim off in different directions and they're not in a row anymore, as we all know. And we spend a lot of extra energy trying to get ducks into a row, or herd the cats of our mind that when they don't want to be herded into one room, you know. And the last form of dukkha or unsatisfactoriness is conditionality itself. The oppressiveness of living in a conditioned world, the need to just be bombarded all the time by sense impressions at a very subtle or a gross level. Going up the stairs and down the stairs and in the room and out the room and needing to all agree on a time when we come together in here. And to wish for ourselves to be free from this most profound form or subtle form of dukkha or oppression, that is sort of where the wisdom and compassion come together. To wish for ourselves and others to be free from even the most subtle imprints of karma, from all traces of dualistic perceptions and the subtlest obstructions to knowledge and wisdom. we really kind of take it to this profound place and we understand what the meaning of this is, you're actually very close to a type of wisdom itself. You're understanding that these things can be removed, that there is a place where, you know, sort of conditions do not reach or do not touch you. The place where, you know, I am not. Knowing that suffering is rooted in fundamental ignorance, you kind of need wisdom to really know that or sense that. It's a more intuitive thing than a gross knowledge, just to see like how these words may resonate with you if they give you a sense of joy. It's not that you have to have a specific sense of understanding them, since the understanding is more intuitive than sort of rational, really. But to know or have a sense that ignorance is removable, that it's not fixed, it's not stuck, it's not definitive, that ignorance is concocted, that ignorance arrives, that Buddha nature is more profound than ignorance, that's more powerful. When you know that ignorance is removable, then your compassion and love becomes greater, because you know there is a way out. But you also then have a sense of responsibility to develop the path in yourself, and to develop it in a way that maybe one day you'll be able to show it to other people. So in the Dalai Lama's teaching, he said that the quickest way to achieve this sense of really cutting to the deepest place of compassion and wisdom together is to develop an understanding of emptiness, that things are not fixed into, and in their method, they use, you know, sort of this very rational analysis of cause and effect and of person, and they ask you to see, you know, where is the I? And I think that often if we are in an emotional state or feeling very deeply kind of trapped in our stories, to start to look around in our body where the story feels like it's lodged or rooted is interesting. But just to give you a quick sense of, you know, this type of analysis is thinking about our joke a little bit about the Red Sox, who are again playing tonight. Mm-hmm. Think about the mind, like those of you who can relate to this at all, you know, think about the mind that doesn't want Cleveland to win. That thinks of Cleveland as something or someone or some group of, like, you know, people who you really want to crush and defeat. And the Red Sox is good and nice and, you know, special and all that stuff, except for Coco Crisp and Lugo at the bottom of them. They should have really traded, or they're going to trade next year. So take that one apart. What are the Red Sox? You know, or this selfish mind. Of mine, like I was in the airplane on the way here and I misread something, like something just kind of went cuckoo in my mind, and I thought I saw in the airline magazine that you can give 20,000 flyer miles to anyone else on the plane. And I thought, no! Just like, no, I don't want to. No, like, I want to, you know, like I can give them to someone, I'd rather have them myself than give them away. You know, it was just this little meh. And then I read, and it was something completely else that was being on the edge. But I saw, you know, what an idiotic mind, like some practitioner here, you know, like, wow. So anyway, the understanding that things are composite or compounded is something that I, you know, encourage in my own practice, and to try to give myself permission to see things like that, the sort of foamy or illusory nature, the constantly changing nature of things, the constantly changing lineup of these teams. You know, Johnny Damon went to the Yankees, he went to the dark side, but he was all washed up anyway. But he used to be ours, and now he's theirs, and what does that mean, you know? The Buddha compared existence to a blob of foam on a river, you know, that the causes and conditions that keep us together, like we are all these little specks in the blob of foam of this retreat. That it, you know, you've seen how foam is on a river. It sort of holds and it has a certain shape, and then it sort of goes through a few whirlpools, and then it spins out, and then it's kind of gone. There's that plaque out in the hall I love. I find it very endearing. On this place in 1846, nothing happened. It gives me a little taste of Nibbana every time I read that thing. But what does our mind do instead? You know, it kind of zeroes in on I want. It creates, you know, fabricates these perspectives and these standpoints, these enmities, not being really open to the panorama of experience. So there are times when, you know, just to banish any and all expectations or sense of how I should be or sense of how my meditation should be, just, you know, if you find yourself not in the condition that you wish you were, try to sort of bawl out all of that that's kind of converging upon you, telling you that you should be different. And sort of, you know, you can give your awareness the sort of capacity to sort of shout at it for a moment and see, you know, after it's all cleared away, what's left as your continuum. Then, of course, it'll all come sneaking back again and things will start to percolate, and then you can see that in themselves they are also blobs of foam. They're not real and substantial. That's a kind of sense of perspective that grows over time in the practice and that is, you know, available in greater and lesser degrees at different times during the day, during the life. But I would also just like to say the value of coming to a place like this, to hear this kind of teaching, this kind of perspective that creates a kind of background reference in the mind against which sort of experience unfolds, so you can sort of see it and you take this sort of information that's in the talk and you use it, you apply it to your experience. So there's awareness, and then there's also the kind of unique perspective that these teachings of emptiness and love offer. Unconditional awareness, unconditional love. Love to all moments. And for all of us, it really is a matter sometimes of coming here on these retreats, like, you know, going to the Boy Scout or the Girl Scout camping trip and seeing what happens and finding that there are more mosquitoes than we wish there were and the marshmallow burned and fell in the fire and all that kind of stuff. But I salute, you know, in all of you, the courage that it takes to come, the willingness and the love for yourselves to be here and just sit, not knowing what will happen, not knowing what will come up, and to some degree or other being willing to receive whatever it is that happens. That kind of willingness is like the North Star that Shakespeare referred to, you know, the star that is the reference to every wandering bark. Willing to be with, I don't like this. Willing to feel anxious when we pay attention to our breath. Willing to see how the format of the retreat shows us our edges. There's often a rub in there, something that we have to be with. You know, I liked this day's, you know, mindful movement better than yesterday's, or I wish I could remember what, you know, she said yesterday so that I could learn it and do it at home. I can't remember it anymore. But it's true that I really, really don't like that kind of slimy stuff that is in between the mushrooms and the green beans and the lunch. Actually, I think the food here is kind of just good enough and not too good. Like, just about right. This willingness to be there, like the essence in Vipassana, is really to be present and be willing to not flee from what's going on. You know, this is called taming the mind, and it has to be done rather gently and with interest. What is it like for this person to eat a salad? You know, find fascination in that. What is it like for this person to go through this retreat? And to have that sense of sort of adventure and curiosity in practice is what they homely call in Asia, is to take hold of your own nose rope, to be very empowered in your own practice, not to be led around either by your mind, by the instructions, by what you hear, by other people, but to look and to be willing to see for yourself. This is the courage of the Dharma practitioner. Try it and see, as you have already. So beginning to see the nature of this mind-body process for yourself, the intimacy of that, and the, you know, the you doing it of that is super important. It's not something that anyone else can do for us or to us. That's kind of part of our inner freedom. When we see how this mind often is relating to the thing that it wishes was there instead of the thing that is there, and how absolutely torturous that can become. One of my friends was talking about how in her book, Martine Batchelor has an excellent new book called Letting Go, which I recommend, Letting Go of Habits. And she talks about how in her house she invited a carpenter to come and build a staircase. And she had this vision of this wonderfully smooth, you know, artisan thing. And the guy in the village just made this, like, dreadful pine thing that was really too steep and stuff. And she said, like, for months and months afterwards, when she climbed the staircase, all she could see was the one that wasn't there, not the one that was. And it was painful to climb it in that state. Now, how many of us have had that experience relating to the thing that isn't there instead of the thing that is, relating to the person that isn't there instead of the person that is, often in sort of the love, going back to the love thing before? Or, you know, how our mind is constantly chewing on some things, you know, just to hear the sound of your mind just going around all the time. We're all like this. I think that's part of what's so great about doing a retreat together, is that there's something about not being alone and not being the only one. And we do get isolated in our minds. And there's something so soothing about doing this, all of us together. Be willing to look at our preferences and our tendencies and to see, you know, which of our preferences are things that are really healthy and lead to happiness, to wisdom, to rest, and to ease. There does need to be ease in the mind for wisdom to arise, really. Some sense of relaxation. Or what parts of our preferences really are a barricade against reality. This whole edifice called sort of our quote-unquote ego mind with all of its needs and fears. This wisdom mind, this I, this inner I, E-Y-E, that we're developing is kind of like a little spy on our ego process, sort of opening up a slightly different perspective on its ordinary doings and, you know, spying on it with a kind of tender and forgiving and laughable side, but also sometimes just a willingness to stop it from going where it wants to go. And I know that it's like there are times during the day when we feel like we're just being crushed by a mountain internally, and this mountain is something invisible that, you know, we're under it, and our little, you know, what was that Peter Sellers movie where the thing falls on the dog? It's just under there, gone. Or when, you know, there's sort of our awareness and our experiences, like watching two mud wrestlers, you know, which one's on top and which one's winning, and they're both completely covered in guck, you know. It's also a way of making this sort of very messy kind of love with ourselves, to find this acceptance through the day, and even to just say that we made it through one more day of life, being together, being with ourselves. This practice is sort of artfully designed to, you know, put us in those places sometimes that ordinarily we would escape. So don't look for necessarily ease and pleasure in your meditation. Don't think that that's what meditation is all about. I think unconsciously we just bring some of the same, you know, desire for escape or numbing out to our practice here. Then it's just like being an ordinary person. But be willing to examine what is stressful in our mind-body continuum with energy and with wisdom. One time, you know, after I just had a fight with my husband, I found myself sort of, you know, shaking inwardly and outwardly, my mind, my body, my legs, and how hard it was to look past that you did something to me and I have got to get sort of something out of you before I can be at peace. And it was like, it was sort of this weird moment of saying, like, you know, like, I don't really have to go there. It's up to me to sort of stop this and address it from a different place, because going back at this person with, you know, all the claws is not going to lead to resolution. I felt both very empowered and very humbled at the same time. Like, oh, wow, yeah. It's kind of my choice before taking revenge. And the gentleness and tenderness that we need also with these patterns to see what it is that is blocking us. Sometimes our patterns of avoidance or of preference, of distraction, of self-loathing, were laid down in us when we were children. And there were things that worked for us at that time. There were things that made it possible for us to survive emotionally or physically. And then we find as we become adults that they become exactly the opposite. They become restrictive. They're the thing that cuts us off. The pattern of, suspicion that just sees, betrayal everywhere and can't receive just an ordinary person's being different. Or the things that we knew that we couldn't open to when our mind was undeveloped, and that now we build entire structures in our lives to avoid. So we come here to study ourselves in this atmosphere of tolerance, discernment, forgiveness, and also the recognition of emptiness. We kind of supervise our mind a little bit, sort of having this notion of the wisdom of equanimity within the stress that arises, the stress that is here, and the stress that passes away. One of the big secrets of the practice is, as Eric was speaking of, and always stresses, I think, wonderfully in his instructions, that there's always some room to choose how we relate to our experience. And if we don't really know that, we won't necessarily find it, because experience will just, like, come from behind and roll us over. Radical teachers tend to shout out this thing about, putting an end to your anxiety and your struggle. Like Krishnamurti, for example, talks about the end, putting an end to conflict here and now. Generally, it seems to take a little while. But there is the power in your own hands to make some choices and find sort of the breathing room in experience and then build on that and have it grow. The instructions for the Satipatthana Vipassana practice and with the four foundations of mindfulness have a wonderful flavor to them in the sutra that they're recorded. When breathing in a long breath, the practitioner knows I'm breathing in a long breath. When breathing in a short breath, the practitioner knows I'm breathing in a short breath. When the mind is lustful, the practitioner knows there is lust. When the mind is peaceful, the practitioner knows there is peace. When the mind is liberated, he or she knows the mind is liberated. When the mind is unliberated, he or she knows that. And he or she abides independent, not clinging to anything in this world. So that simple recognition is incredibly, incredibly powerful. That recognition in the moment of the thing as it actually is. And I think as I speak, I want to ask you if you can feel the difference of when you approach the moment as it is, when you find that willingness in the mind to approach the moment just as it is, and to be with it and to open the mind to it. When I was writing this talk, I had an experience of that, the liberation that can come with that. I was thinking, like, well, I wonder what I can talk about. This is a four-day retreat, what will they understand? It's sort of short, and maybe they're all really, like, kind of agitated, and they're not going to, blah, blah, go home with any kind of understanding at all. And then just in recognizing the thought and feeling the sort of the barrier, the doubt, the aversion, feeling it as it was, and watching it little crumble away and disappear because I had seen it so directly, and seeing the separation between sort of my intention and you and the sense of the situation just completely disappear, the relief of that, and the sense of how, sort of what's toxic becomes non-toxic in that recognition. There's nothing that compares with that type of happiness of release, I must say. So to come to the end of this talk, when the Buddha talked about this kind of incomparable sense of freedom that he had discovered in himself, which is the freedom that we can taste in our own experience, in this willingness to turn toward, in this willingness to examine, in this willingness to be impartial, in this willingness to be with long breaths, short breaths, lust, peace, liberated minds, unliberated minds, narrow minds, wide minds, body sensations, ringing bells, chaos, whatever. The Buddha said, so there's a prince, he said, you know, there's a prince who's enjoying all the pleasures of life. Who can imagine, you know, sort of Brad and Angelina, maybe, or somebody our various deva people with the deva existences on this planet, and they have sort of everything, and they have pleasure, and they have happiness, and they have money, and they have basically the capacity to do whatever they want within their human form. And then because they were nice and they were good and they adopted so many children from Cambodia, they die and they're reborn in a heavenly realm where the pleasures are incredibly exquisite, even more than Hollywood. How do you think that deva would look upon the pleasures of the human world? Would the deva want to go back and have those pleasures again? No. Right. So that, you know, it's sort of a dialogue. And they say, no, you know, the exquisitely refined pleasures of the celestial realm are so superior, where, you know, you don't have to walk on legs. You just think you're somewhere and you end up, you know, it's more than the Concorde or whatever, you know. And then he said, no, I would never go back to sort of the common sense of pleasure and happiness from the kind of peace of mind that I enjoy now. Then he went on to say, like, the way that I see, this is kind of bad, he said, the way that I see this sense of craving to be something other, you know, that this kind of greedy side of life that's always not accepting, that's always seeing the pine stair, the smooth, beautiful staircase instead of the staircase that's there. He said, that's, to me, that's like a leper who jumps into a fire to try to get rid of the pain of the leprosy. You know, that do you think that the fire is really going to heal them, or do you think that medicine is actually going to heal the pain that they have? You know, if there's the medicine, take the medicine and not jump into the fire. Very radical example. So for the concluding stanzas of that discourse, he said, those who abide free from suffering are those who have actually understood the origin, the disappearance, the gratification, the danger, and the escape in sensual pleasures. So it means that these are the people who have actually really looked directly at the nature of life. That is how you reach the understanding to abide free from craving. I'm just going to read it again. The origin, the disappearance, the gratification, the danger, and the escape in sensual pleasures. And they have abandoned craving, removing their fever. They abide healed, free from thirst, with the mind inwardly at peace. So where else? We're in the perfect time, we're in the perfect place, we're the perfect person to perform this investigation and to see this for ourselves. So thank you for listening.